from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. I welcome you. We have a packed and empowering program today. We're going to talk about why it's so important to stay productive throughout your entire life, Harvard University. New study finds a link between the omega-3 fatty acids and reduced hospital stays, Sherbrooke University in the United Kingdom. Exercise can help thwart ovarian cancer, Roswell Park Cancer Institute. Strawberry powder, and I know some of you are using that. Study tips nitrate drink for overweight teenagers to improve their heart, University of California. And inflamed and stressed, rejuvenating antioxidants are in big demand in helping people, and a lot more in health and healing. Then we're going to go to our guests in the second part of our program today. Normally share insights from our guests in the last half. We have two unique people, Professor Charles Gerber, Professor of Sociology at Boston College, and a prolific philosopher on the subject of capitalism, and Professor Yale Magris. And Yale Magris is the Chancellor Professor of Sociology and Anthropology, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth campus, where he concentrates on the sociology of empowering civil society in the 99% through social reform. We're going to talk about how the U.S. has become a bullying nation and its consequences. Then I will be sharing an insight into the 17 reasons to say no to glyphosate. This is a special public health original article. It'll be posted on PRN.fm. And I will be giving you the good news that over 52% of the British population said, we want to get out of the European Union. That's terrific. Why? And I will offer what no one was talking about in the media. They were making it very political. They were making it left and right, conservative and liberal. It has nothing to do with that. I'll show you the real metastasized cancer inside of the political establishment of the European Union. I'll show you the 5 reasons that they should have been out a long time ago. My hope is that Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, France, and Ireland will also have referendums to leave. And finally, that entire house of cards will collapse. Also today, I will share how to stop terrorism worldwide. ISIS, the al-Nusra Front, ISIL, it doesn't matter what they call themselves, al-Qaeda, you can stop it. Within about a year, you could eliminate 98% of all terrorism throughout the world. How? I'll share that with you, time permitting. So as you see, we have a packed show. Let's begin. First up, I'm a big believer that we should be eating healthy, wherever possible, locally grown produce. And the reason is simple, because we don't get enough fruits and vegetables in our diet. Every study shows that we're not getting it. Why are we not getting it? Because we're displacing the good, healthy fruits, nuts, vegetables and seeds, legumes and tubers with a meat-based diet. It's meat and sugar products. That's what we're getting. So if you eat a lot of meat, you're not going to have room or desire the fruits and vegetables. But it's the fruits and vegetables that actually heal us, that turn on the DNA healing genes. This is the University of California. Upping nitrate intake through a daily strawberry powder drink may be one strategy to improving cardiovascular health, a study in overweight teen boys has suggested. Now, this was a randomized, double-blind, crossover study, and the boys were 14 to 18, and we have an epidemic in obesity in boys and girls who are teenagers now. We have 80 million people in the United States who are between birth and 18. That's a big segment of the population. And it's a little over a fourth. So they're not eating well, nor are they drinking well. So this study showed how a fresh glass made up of strawberries and powder of strawberries was able to burn fat, help their heart, lower their markers in their blood. And this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. Now, at the top of all that was nitrate. You've heard me mention many times that we should be having a glass, a 6-ounce glass of beet juice. I think an ideal would be 6 ounces of beet, 6 ounces of fresh coconut water. You're getting your potassium and your electrolytes in the coconut. You're getting your nitrate and other B complex in the beet juice. What they did here is they measured the markers of vascular health at baseline and 1 hour after drinking the strawberry mix. And they saw an immediate improvement in some of the participants' nitrate levels. Quote from the study. As a group, fasting nitrite levels did not significantly change after 1 week of control or the freeze-dried powder intake. However, for those individuals, fasting nitrate levels increased in time and stayed increased, and that was very positive. So, here's the takeaway message. Strawberries are very high in naturally occurring nitrate, as are beets, when compared to other types of fruit. And that helps you get more blood through your veins. In effect, it's like turning the pressure on when you just turn on to wash your hands and you get a little bit of a pressure. When you have nitrate in a food, it's like turning that pressure all the way up so water really flows, the blood really flows to your brain, to your muscles. And when it flows to your muscles are better able to respond to create more ATP, adenosine triphosphate reaction, which is the combustion. Or another way of looking at it, visualize the strawberry and the blueberry and pomegranate as the fuel, the wood you throw into a wood-burning stove. The more wood you put in there, the hotter the flame, the more heat is brought out. Same thing with the berries. So every time you have any fresh strawberries or juiced berries or powder from berries, which is the best of all, you're really helping your heart. And that's the bottom line. Now, exercise is also important for women. This is from Roswell Park Cancer Institute, published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. A lack of exercise is associated with an increased risk of ovarian cancer and death from ovarian cancer. Not one, but two new studies show this. Quote, women may be overwhelmed with mixed messages about physical activity or exercise recommendations and opt to be inactive because they feel that they cannot meet the recommended amount of physical activity. Our findings suggest that any amount of regular weekly recreational physical activity may reduce the risk for and improve survival from ovarian cancer. While a lack of regular exercise throughout adulthood is associated with an increased risk of developing and dying from ovarian cancer. That was from a professor, Kristen Moisch, professor of oncology at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo. And they looked at almost 20,000 women in this study. So here's the takeaway message. Always exercise. Every time anyone with cancer exercises, the oxygen you're breathing in, the high oxygenated blood, is killing cancer cells. Cancer cells do not thrive in a high oxygen medium. And hence the antioxidants to promote oxygenation, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, tocotrienols, these help kill cancer. So exercise and help your cancer. A new study from Sherbrooke University in the United Kingdom, published in the Clinical Nutrition, took a look at a meta-analysis. A meta means many. They took a look at this and they found that cardiac patients, surgery patients, who received the omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids or a placebo in advance of surgery, experienced reduced postoperative cardiac arrhythmias and significantly reduced the length of hospital stay by 2.4 days. And that's a whole lot. When you consider that every day in your hospital you run the risk of infection, you run the risk of wrong medication, you run the risk of death from being in a hospital today. Now you can get your omega-3s from walnuts, avocado, flaxseed, or fish. You can get them either in a vegan source or non-vegan source, but both of them reduce your stay in a hospital, and that is important. So always make sure that you got your omega-3s. Now, there's another reason for doing this, too. This is from Soochow University in China, published in Scientific Reports. Again, it's a meta-analysis. They looked at all these studies, 11 studies, with over 371,000 participants, and they found that the omega-3s reduced death from all causes. And the more you took, the less likely you were to die. So if you took 300 milligrams, you had a reduced risk. But if you took 1,200 milligrams, where I believe you should be is up around 2,000 milligrams, 1,000 in the morning, 1,000 in the late afternoon, you really reduce your risk substantially. So, hey, if we can put time on our side by taking something that could give us a 20% decrease in the risk of all-cause mortality, quote, all-cause mortality, here's what it says, quote, from the study, the meta-analysis of 11 prospective observational studies demonstrate that each 1% increment of omega-3 fatty acids in total fatty acids in blood may be associated with a 20% decrease in the risk of all-cause mortality. This is an important finding for potential contribution of adequate omega-3 intake to public health, end quote. That's a major study. That's a major statement also. Just imagine most people are taking supplements from my experience, and I'm not a lay person. I'm a registered dietitian. I'm a clinical nutritionist. I'm board certified in my field. I'm a doctorate, postdoctorate. I did 22 years as a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, plus another 10 years before that as when I was not a fellow. So I've had a lot of experience counseling over 70,000 people, and I can tell you that 99.9%, almost every single person I see who says, oh, I'm healthy, my doctor, he's giving me supplements, and I review them, and then I look at their conditions, they're way under using it. Vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, way underutilizing it. Someone was, just recently I was counseling, and they had terrible pains. They couldn't sleep at night, which when you don't sleep at night, you end up with immune dysfunction. And then with immune dysfunction, they lost weight. Then they had local infections. They had bladder infections, and they had joint swelling, and they had allergies, and they had clogged sinuses. And then they ended up with shingles outbreaks. Well, the shingles wasn't because they were active in any way with a virus. That was probably 50 years ago they were infected, and possibly through the vaccine. But when your immune system is overstretched, when you are overworked, when you're undersleeping, when you're overreacting and your adrenals are exhausted, you're going to get herpes outbreaks. It doesn't matter what protocol you're on. That's why I've said many times, stop thinking that a supplement or a magical food or that a particular anything is going to, in and of itself, change all this. It has to be a combination, and it has to be much like guiding an orchestra so it all is in harmony. You have the same kind of harmonizing necessary for your health. And everybody was taking way too much. So this one person had all these pains, couldn't sleep at night. And I said, what about your nutrition? Oh, my doctor's a holistic doctor, and he's got me on all. How much magnesium are you taking? Oh, I'm taking a lot, 300 milligrams. 300? Why don't we go up to 1,200? 1,200, isn't that a lot? Well, remember, only a small fraction of magnesium is elemental, and it's only the elemental that's actually absorbed. The rest goes right through your body, unabsorbed. And what kind of magnesium? Well, he didn't say just magnesium. Well, if you're taking coral calcium, that's just junk magnesium. You should be taking a combination of calcium from citrate, calcium from, you can also take it from chelate, or magnesium oxide, not calcium, but magnesium oxide. But let's take it 1,200 in the morning and 800 at night. Won't that cause diarrhea? Could, and if it does, just bring it down. Two nights later, slept through the night, no pain. That's important. Now, when they were sleeping better and they didn't have any pain and their muscles, the calves, weren't cramping up, then the person was able to have their immune system recover. Now there are no more shingles outbreaks, no more herpes outbreaks, and so now the person's able to function. The sinus is drained. I had him go for a power walk an hour each morning and 20 minutes each afternoon, and that drains the sinuses and drains the mucus. So now the person in 2 weeks is like a new human being, something that simple. So when I'm suggesting what people should be taking, the amount of vegetables and fruits in their diet, the amount of fatty acids, it's a lot more. You got some doctors out there who have no back. You know what? This was interesting. This is a little aside. I wanted to help the holistic medical doctors who are being attacked by the quack busters. By the way, there's someone sent out on the internet an attack against the quack busters and was using what no one knows. The quack busters are sued for slander and libel. They go into court. They present their evidence, and the court shows that they're not qualified to talk about health and nutrition. They have no background in it. They were a psychiatrist or something else, and no background. And so the Supreme Court or the Circuit Court in California said, you are unqualified as an expert witness. And yet these are the people who had held the entire health community hostage by threatening them, denouncing them for 30 years. Now they've been just completely disengaged from reality. So just remember, if you're a physician, a chiropractor, a holistic nurse, and you're attacked by one of these people, let us know, because we have volumes of information on how these people lack any qualification to be an expert against anyone in the health movement. But they act like they know everything about everything. They know nothing about anything. And they're all aligned with the pharmaceutical industry. But in any case, I got all the holistic doctors in New York City together for a meeting. There were about 38. I won't mention any names, but they were a who's who of all the doctors who are practicing any form of holistic medicine. And I simply suggested, you're all being attacked, or will be. Why don't you simply set aside 1% of your annual income into a nonprofit foundation that is there with lawyers to help you so you don't go broke if you're personally attacked? Also, that foundation can do research on the nature of each kind of therapy you're using to show the legitimacy and science of it, indeed, if it's legitimate and is scientifically based. They all thought it was a great idea. Not one person put one penny in it. And all of them ended up getting attacked. And then they had no preparation, and I would go in and help them. And you're looking at $300,000-$500,000. And then they would be found guilty on some technicality they should have been smart enough to realize. And in any case, one day we had a meeting 2 years later. And I said, did it ever occur to any of you that maybe you ought to actually take a course in health, public health, or nutrition? Because unless I miss something, not one single holistic doctor in America has any official background or knowledge or academic training or published science or has ever done a clinical study ever in your lives. So where do you come off saying that you're holistic when you're eating meat, you're sick, you drink, you're out of shape? Am I not seeing something here? And they were kind of looking at each other like, well, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And that was the last time I met with any of them. I'm so fed up with the holistic medical community because they're neither holistic. There are doctors, but most of them are very self-serving. So be very careful when you go into any so-called holistic doctor's office, because the likelihood is that you're just a mortgage payment, unfortunately. There were a few who were legitimate, unfortunately, they're not around today. But remember, those people attacking also don't have any background. How in the hell, if you're just a pathologist, can you be an expert on nutrition? Where'd you learn? What class did you take? What test did you take? What papers have you published based upon what you have studied? Anybody can call themselves anything, and unfortunately the public is held vulnerable to that. More often than not, all this behind it, someone selling something. That's unfortunate. I think the public's been exploited enough. Finally, a high fiber diet and vitamin A, according to Monash University in Australia, are keys in preventing allergies of all types. Quote, from this study published in Cell Reports, eating a diet rich in fiber can actually shape the immune system to reduce allergies to substances such as peanuts, new research show. This study led by Australian scientists suggested a simple bowl of bran and some dried apricots in the morning could prevent allergies. It also reveals how the immune system works with the good bacteria in the gut to help protect against life-threatening allergic responses. This was published in Cell Reports and revealed that we just don't have enough fiber in the diet. Well, of course we don't have enough fiber. We should be getting 40 to 50 grams a day, and it shouldn't just be from bran. It should be roughage. And unfortunately, for commercial reasons only, they took the good work of three doctors. The first was Dr. John Cleave, who I went to England to interview on this back in the 1970s. And then it was Professor John Yuckin, the first professor to hold a professorship in a European university. He was in Great Britain in nutrition. And he was the one who coined the notion of what was known as a saccharine condition. And then there was Professor Dennis Burkitt, of Burkitt's lymphoma fame, who found that in 67 East African clinics and hospitals that he oversaw for years, he never saw a heart attack. He never saw colorectal cancer, never saw appendicitis, never saw ileitis, because they have such high roughage. So they wrote in their own time, and pretty much around the same time, within a 10-year period, there were some important reports that nobody read, but they were important. And they all said the same thing. The more natural roughage, not fiber, roughage in the diet, the healthier the intestines, and the greater the cleansing, and the less likely colorectal cancer, etc. Well, someone got the wise idea. Let's convert roughage, meaning the whole food, to fiber, something that we can take like a milled fiber. And then we got one product, and it's very profitable, and let's promote fiber. And we can throw fiber into some muffins. We can throw fiber into anything. That wasn't the way it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be roughage. So when you're eating beans and legumes and pulses, when you're having a dal soup, when you're having a tomato salad, when you're having a cress salad, when you're having a handful of walnuts, pistachios, almonds, cashews, macadamias, when you're eating root vegetables, kohlrabi and rutabaga, you're getting roughage. And it's the roughage fibers that really help our body heal and promote healthy geobiome in the gut, which helps us. That's the latest on health nutrition. We're going to take a break and come back for our guests. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you. Let's go now up to Massachusetts, where my guests are standing by. Professor Charles Derber, professor of sociology at Boston College and a prolific author specializing in political economy and sociology and the environment and social change. And he's written on the economic crisis and capitalism and globalization and corporate culture, fascism, war and peace, and progressive movements, and is perhaps best known for analyzing the dynamics of corporate power. He has a long background in human rights activism, having worked with voting African Americans in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in the 1960s and protesting the Vietnam War. Professor Durber received degrees from Yale, later a doctor from University of Chicago. And he is well known for his books, including Sociopathic Society, The Morality Wars, and most recently, Bully Nation, How the American Establishment Creates a Bullying Society, co-written with our other guest, Professor Yale Magris. Now, Professor Magris is the Chancellor Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth Campus, where he concentrates on the sociology of empowering civil society and the 99% through cultural and social reform, particularly in our educational systems. His work includes investigating the dynamics of authority and its negative impact and consequences, and how the political economy can serve either the 1% or the 99%, and he's been published many times over the many decades. He has been discussing, researching, writing on these topics, including Surplus America, How the 1% is Making Us Redundant, with Professor Durber. He holds a doctor from the University of California at Santa Barbara and degrees from Columbia University and Brandeis University. I'd like to welcome both of you to our program today.
Well, thanks for having us. Thanks, Gary. It's nice to be here.
I would like to begin by introducing our topic with a look at Donald Trump. And not his political stance, nor his domestic and economic proposals, but what he represents, in my personal opinion, that has attracted so much attention among a surprising segment of the American population. And no one would argue that Trump is not a bully. Even his most ardent supporters would agree. But what is most disturbing to me is that they admire him for his vicious bullying quality. So he ideally represents something else going on and underlying a large portion of our culture. And then, of course, our mainstream media further perpetrates this illness by constantly giving him so much attention rather than just ignoring him altogether, which they should have been doing from the start. And as you, I'm assuming, would also concur, this pathological trait is also characteristic of many of the oligarch elite, both in the public and private sectors. Even regarding Hillary Clinton, she may give a faux feminist face of tolerance to the public, but her foreign policy stances as Secretary of State are prime examples of the psychology of bullying and how she uses this in a way that is entitling, as if she is privileged to be able to bully other nations. One example would be Libya. And I remember having Morris Berman on this program, and his analysis and review of the U.S. was founded on a tradition of hustling. America is a nation of hustlers, and hustling is also a form of bullying, and our institutions do that all the time. So please begin, whichever one of you would like to take this, I know you're both in the same room there, and talk about, let us not just look at Donald Trump as a lone example of a classical bully, but as representative of a much larger segment of the American population, and particularly the American political and corporate elite. The forum is yours.
Thanks, Gary. This is Charlie Durber. That's a very good, astute introduction of our book, because we do argue in the book that bullying, despite the sort of pejorative things often associated with it in schools, anti-bullying programs and so forth, which we might want to return to, our basic argument is exactly as you say, that we have a national bullying culture which is embedded in the larger political and economic system that we're all living under. That is, we call it militarized capitalism in the book, and we think that both militarism and capitalism, independently and intertwined, are both essentially bullying system. I mean, a capitalism system is a system where you have substantial inequalities of power, and wherever you have, you know, structural, institutional inequalities of power or personal inequalities of power, you have very strong potentialities for bullying and for values associated with it. So the greater the inequality of power, the more likely you are to have bullying going on either by individuals or by institutions. So we argue in the book that psychiatrists and psychologists have largely sort of monopolized the conversation on bullying and focused it as a kid thing in schools. And our book really takes it in the direction that you said in your intro, that bullying is actually carried out by adults, children largely mimicking adults, and they're soaking up and absorbing values and behavior that they see, you know, carried out by the most powerful people in society. And so because to run a corporation, as Donald Trump has, or to run a kind of superpower like the United States, it's true that the elites generally, because it's in the it's sort of baked into the DNA of the system that a capitalist militarized system is going to require a lot of threats and routinized intimidation of other countries and of people within this country who work for a living and so forth. This is just sort of part of the DNA of our culture. And I think you're right. I mean, I like the way you introduced this, that people are paying a lot of attention to his temperament and the sort of extreme authoritarian and bullying character that he has. But I think two things. One is, you're right that Hillary Clinton's policies are in some ways just as or greater than his. In terms of her, she's much more interventionist militarily, as you suggested, in Libya, in no-fly zones in Syria and so forth. And her general, you know, relation to Wall Street and to the sort of more powerful forces that have been, you know, essentially intimidating and threatening the working classes in the United States and abroad, she has very close relations to. So I think, yeah, go ahead. No, I just wanted to say our book takes the position that it's something deeply embedded in the culture as a whole, and that in some sense there is a good deal of admiration for Trump because he in some way is overtly expressing things that people are expected to live by in their everyday life. I think Yale might want to.
The anti-bullying movement that Charlie's speaking about is actually relatively recent. That bullies for a very, very long time have actually been people you admire, people you want to emulate. And there's a very long history, not just America, but perhaps worldwide, of people without power, oftentimes themselves bully victims, identifying with the bully, somehow viscerally absorbing his power, and in a way feeling protected by somebody who can intimidate you. And in a very real way, Trump is an example of this. You don't necessarily have to have a bully personality to bully. I think... Hello?
I'm here. We're listening.
Yeah.
We can hear you.
Am I picking up?
Yes, we can hear you. Please continue. Please continue. We can hear what you're saying.
Am I picking up?
Yeah, go back further to the, yes.
Yeah, we can hear you.
But I mean, did you hear what I had already said?
Yes, we're hearing everything you're saying.
Okay.
So sorry about that. No problem. I mean, Obama, for example, may not necessarily have a bullying personality, but he certainly has bombed. He certainly has carried out the World Wall Street. He certainly has made other countries. Whatever Hillary's personality is, she can do the same thing. But Trump does have what psychologists would identify as a classical bullying personality. And he does exude power and authority that very often people lacking it feel they need a leader who, in fact, himself displays it. And they can feel power through him. It's almost the same sort of thing that happens in a sports team. When a sports team wins, very often people with minimal athletic skills somehow feel they have acquired the victory. We won. When your country's army wins a battle, we won. You want to identify with the powerful if you yourself have no power, because it gives you a sense of having some purpose, having some direction.
Think about the reaction of the establishment, particularly the Republican Party, against Trump. You might say, well, this is contrary to what these guys are saying because they seem to be rejecting his bullying quality. But I think what's happening here is that essentially what Trump is doing is that his personality, as Yale just said, is so prototypically an extreme bullying that it exposes it kind of takes the cloak off the more, quote, civil bullying that is characteristic of most of the elite who operate by a somewhat more restrained code. And I think one of the reasons they attack him is that, you know, the people who do within the Republican Party and so forth, is that he is so classically extreme in his bullying and sort of the ultimate, schoolyard bully kid, that he's ripping the shroud, the sort of the thing that hides what you were first talking about, which is that the policies and the way that the economic and political systems operate is biological bullying. It's a power-oriented system, and it requires that most leaders operate in a way, whether they're personal bullies or not, the institutions that they're leading are constantly requiring that they threaten to fire workers if they don't give up benefits and wages, and to act in a bullying way toward other countries and so forth. So we think this is a systemic issue, and that the whole conversation about bullying has been subject to a kind of psychological reductionism because it's so focused on children and schools. And we don't think that that's unimportant. We think bullying is real in schools, and it can be very, very damaging psychologically. So we're not trying to argue that that the classical way of thinking about bullying is not relevant. But what we're trying to show is that if you really want to deal with that problem, you have to sort of widen your angle of vision and think about the way the whole structure of the society is set up. Because what kids, when they are involved in this, are doing is really just being prepared for their adult lives, which is based on a bullying culture and a bullying set of institutions. And if you don't go along and play along, you're not going to be able to survive within that system.
I appreciate that insight.
The bullying in school is very real. And as Charlie just said, it actually is preparation for living in a bullying society where you are either a bully or a bully victim, or in many cases, simultaneously both. In fact, teachers, as an example, and teachers very often do not have bullying personalities. Their goal is to build creativity, build level learning, but they're faced with a grading system where they are forced to impose competition. They're forced to rank. They're forced to give ideas of scarcity resources. And they do things that actually undermine level learning. They're effectively bullied into being bullied. And, of course, the children will pick up this bullying culture. And we don't want to imply that children will not bully on their own. But schools, even if they are officially against bullying, have a subterranean culture among the children where bullying is fostered and, in fact, encouraged. I think that was universally accepted before the recent anti-bullying movement. I mean, you can go back to things like Tom Brown's School Days, a book written about British private schools in the 1800s, and it's all about the joy of bullying. It's all about how you get beat up, you beat other people up, and you feel power, and you then are going to go up to run the British Empire. And you, in fact, in schools, want training three people who both don't run corporations or be line workers, people who go into run military institutions or be the grunts on the front lines. And you want to create a bullying hierarchy. It's a reproduction of the entire military capital system.
Let me summarize what I'm hearing both of you gentlemen say. I'm hearing you say that we have to pull back and look at bullying not only as how it manifests, but also the psychology of bullying, because this is a real public health issue. Now, I've seen reports that 75% of school shootings are related to bullying and school harassment, and many suicides are associated with being victimized by bullies. So we're dealing with a widespread chronic illness, and then there is an entire infrastructure built up into the society today that actually promotes bullying, particularly through the media. And you're telling us, if I'm hearing you correctly, that much of our behavior as individuals and our collective behavior is based upon this almost sociopathic conditioning. For example, the bullying in the media when we wanted to go to war in Iraq. Many of us tried to show that we shouldn't go, and we were bullied. And our audiences were told that they were foolish. And then you look at the people in a prison system. Nowhere are you going to find bullying more extreme than in the minority community that represents 2.2 million people in prisons. They represent over 65%, almost 70%. And in prisons, there's a whole hierarchical structure based upon violence, and that violence is based upon bullying. You either, you know, join a gang, or you're going to be bullied, and you're going to be harassed or hurt. And we don't look at it. We don't look at the intrinsic bullying in a free market capitalism and the engine of behind globalization. We don't look at bullying in the military-industrial complex, or how we train the military personnel, or push to militarize other nations in our image. We don't look at the bullying to say our food should not be genetically engineered, when many of us says, well, yes, we want to know where our food comes from. And then we're looked upon as people who do not know what we're talking about. If we stand up against gas or hydrofracking, if we stand up against the exploitation of people, exploitation of labor, we are completely sidelined, and that is a form of bullying. So I'm hearing you say, if I'm correct, that bullying has become a cottage industry, and that the anti-bullying movement today should look at how we can change the political perceptions in certain groups within the U.S. electorate, and especially with young people who supported Bernie Sanders or Joel Stein, and start calling out this bullying in any form that it takes, and against unions or whatever it is, for what it is. Am I hearing you correct?
I think you are, but it's more than a cottage industry, Gary. It's in the way we developed this in the book, which is called Bully Nation, for a reason. We mean that bullying is embedded in the entire systemic character of the nation. You've just very well outlined, you know, from the military to the prisons to the economic structure and so forth, what the components, subsections of that system are. But it's not a cottage industry. It's really the core and dominant model, and people have to learn to essentially go along with this. Now, let me give you one little story or picture of why I classically the way Americans learn to think about problems, which is to think about them as individual psychological aberrations. So imagine you're in Times Square and you're taking pictures of people and you're using a zoom camera, and you zoom up and you focus on people's faces. And you see all the signs of anxiety and personal emotional distress and so forth. And you then start to develop all kinds of psychological theories of what's going on that's making these people respond in this way. Well, you've zoomed in, and now let's say you zoom back out, and you look at the buildings. I don't know if you're anywhere near Rockefeller Center in New York, but let's imagine that what's actually happening is that the buildings themselves are falling apart or are falling in on people. Then you would suddenly realize, by looking at simply spending all your time analyzing the psychological dynamic of what's going on in people's faces, which can be quite, you know, seductive and powerful, I mean, emotionally gripping, you're missing the whole wider angle vision, which says, oh boy, we better look at those buildings surrounding these people if we want to understand. So we think this is why people have not developed this sort of larger analysis of bullying as a systemic structural problem as against a psychological one. And that's very much part of the intellectual architecture of American life. If people actually learn to think this way, for the reasons that you just said, it would lead to massive sort of uprisings by the population. As long as people think the system is good, or you don't have to think about it, and we have to adjust the people to that system, then they will be attracted to this sort of more psychological preoccupation. If they understand that bullying is actually a kind of sickness built into the structure of the society itself, I've done another book called The Sociopathic Society, where I developed the same kind of argument, then that's going to lead people to question things that the elites don't want people to think about. So in some sense, we're trying to take a massive social issue that has a lot of traction in society about bullying and trying to say, let's rescue this from the discourse of psychology and psychiatry. Not to say that there aren't important psychological dimensions of this and scars of this, but to say that if you want to get a handle on this and move toward a much less violent and psychologically debilitating kind of society, you've got to look at and change the systemic features of it.
I would agree with that.
Right, Bill, very famous sociologist called Social Imagination, where he said, look at personal problems alone. You have to understand personal problems as a reflection of broader public issues. Bullying, we think, is a classical example. The psychological approach to bullying says it's all in your head. And in fact, what are you told to do? You're told to bear with it, put up with it, overcome it, build up your own self-image. Get over it. It's your problem. You're simultaneously told that, and you're not allowed to look at how you really, in fact, do lack power, how you're not in position to, in fact, gain control of your own life because other people, in fact, control it for you. And you, very often, children are given this very contradictory message that they have to hold themselves straight, they have to look like they're kind of be intimidated, implying it's their own fault, while at the same time they're told, there's nothing wrong with you. You're very pretty, you're very smart, you're very strong, you're appreciated. How seriously would you expect a bully child to expect that when he or she knows that they may not be conventionally attractive, they may not be very well liked, they may in fact not be that physically strong. So they're being basically by psychologists or by adult authorities being fed what they in fact will see as essentially lies. They cannot take seriously, which is
I think Gary,
Gentlemen, we're out of time, but you've made so many important points, and your work is extremely important for us to know. How do we understand bullying? How do we respond to it? And how, as you just mentioned, Professor Magris, how do we stop believing in the contradictions and those who are not actively seeking to change the underlying foundational base of bullying, as so that we don't have to somehow always fear? Even a parent who fears in California now, she must give her kids vaccines, even if she's a scientist, a physician, and knows they will not prevent a disease or may cause a disease. She's bullied into it, or she can't put her kid in the school system. On so many levels, you have raised our awareness that these we must address. We can no longer walk away from, disguise them, hide them, or mislabel them. So for your good work, and I want people to read this very, very important book, Bully Nation, How the American Establishment Creates a Bullying Society, co-written by Professor Yale Magris, M-A-G-R-A-S-S, and Professor Charles Gerber, D-E-R-B-E-R. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much.
And now I want to save a little time for a commentary. I will push off to our next program some of the other issues, including glyphosate, which the article is published on our website, so you can certainly read it and use it at any time. But first, I want to say to all of our listeners in the United Kingdom, including Scotland and Wales, good for you for exiting. But the mainstream media and the British media and those think tanks or multinational corporations and neoliberal agendists had been misguiding people. Here's why we should have put clear attention upon the right issues in the European Union. A, they take away the power of each of their 28 nations that are members. How so? In 2005, they met to create their own constitution, and that constitution would have had power over any other body's constitution. Even though England is based upon the original Magna Carta and the Treaty of Rome and others adjustments to it, all that would have been set aside. It is the perfect example of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which only really benefits the multinational geopolitical agenda. It is all based upon hegemony, the power to those who are smart enough to put themselves in a position to control the outcome. So they wanted to have a constitution, and would have, had it not been for Denmark and one other country. I think it was the Netherlands, not sure on that, that stopped it. But they would have been right back there, and sooner or later it would have passed, which meant that the French constitution, the Italian constitution, the Spanish constitution would have been worthless. They never talked about that. Could you imagine how significant it is to take away a nation's sovereignty? Well, you have no sovereignty. You have no authority of law. That is all determined by number two, that they never talked about. Unelected individuals who are not known, who meet in secret, who keep no minutes, don't have to, and whose rules cannot be changed or challenged in any court of law. Now, that's one of the reasons many of us were against GATT, NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, and, of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership, because these would have taken any environmental law, any health law, and they would have made them null and void. So whatever those corporations wanted, if they didn't want to have any interference with giving us a product that would be contaminated, we couldn't sue them. We couldn't stop them from importing that. And if we tried to, then they would have their own inside lawyers adjudicate it without appeal, and then fine, with massive fines, whatever perceived loss of profits would happen. Same is true in the European Union. So let me give you one example. Number three, at one time, Great Britain had one of the most robust and comprehensive fishing industries in the world. And today, it is almost non-existent. In fact, of the over 100 miles of shoreline, I'm not talking about the Thames now, I'm talking about their coastal waters, all these warehouses are virtually empty. In fact, in one giant warehouse, there's one tiny little corner that had about 20 boxes of partially filled with fish. Why? Because the European Union had taken away the sovereignty of the British people being able to go out and fish their own waters. Instead, it gave them a little tiny piece of water they could fish, not enough to supply even a small amount of the fish for the people who had previously been there. Then they paid pennies on the dollar to destroy, literally destroy, tear down all of the fishing wharf businesses. So an entire industry and all the people who had lived on that and had a living wage and supported themselves and their families all wiped out. That was the European Union. Why not a word about that? The destruction of local economies. Three, and the most insidious, in my opinion, was that without telling anyone, the European Union had taken apart the power of local councils, which are everywhere in Great Britain, and they have a long history. Many people just volunteer to sit on town councils because they're concerned about the issues within their community, and they want to see that things are done correctly and to the needs of the local constituents. And hence, it's always been a great place to debate and have people with different points of view who represent the local constituents know that they have voices. The European Union had quietly put into place a systems change in every one of the different areas of the United Kingdom, Wales and Great Britain and Scotland, where no longer would the rules and laws of the local community be of any value. Everything that controls your life, the school districts, everything that you do locally would come out of Brussels. So if you didn't like it, who do you go to? Which office? You're not told. Can you meet with people there? No, you cannot. Unless they want to meet with you, you have no standing. And what if it's something that destroys your economy, destroys the quality of your educational system? It's irrelevant to them. Where in the world would any country want to be governed by people that you can't meet, who make rules you can't change, who are not elected, and you can't get rid of them? for the 48% of the people who did not vote to exit, I'm sure that if they knew the full truth, it would have given them a different perspective. And also, the European Union was moving to have its own standing army. Now, you know how dangerous it is when you have standing armies that are aligned with NATO. So it was France and Italy and Great Britain that supported the NATO bombing in Yugoslavia, the NATO bombing in Libya, and other places. So they were really controlled by NATO. They were allowing the European Union to be used, with its 28 member states, nations, to be used as a proxy for NATO, one of the most nefarious, corrupt, violent organizations on the planet. NATO is no longer used as a defense against incursion. Rather, it's been used as a perpetrator, as a regime changer. So now you are free. And also now you are free to have your own currency. You're free to have your own trading partners. Look, Great Britain, you can now trade with the United States and Canada and China and Russia and Brazil and South Africa and India without anyone telling you what you can and can't do. And you will be able to create more industry. You'll be able to renegotiate your own tax structure because you're not sending billions and billions of pounds off to a bloated, corrupt bureaucracy where not a single penny has to be accounted for. The European Union is simply evil incarnate. If we want to know what we should not have because of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, look at Great Britain and look at the European Union nations being controlled by this invisible government. Thank goodness you're out. And now I know that the world's free nations, including the Commonwealth, which is over 40 nations, will work together to support your efforts. And so the naysayers will be wrong. And also, look at what the European Union did. Look what Germany, a completely corrupt country, did. With Merkel, my God, she is a fascist. Look at what these people did to poor Greece. Greece, 95% of the money given through the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and private vulture capitalists is not given to the people of Greece. They give them a tranche of maybe $12 billion that goes to service their debt. That goes to these people who bought debt at high interest, 8%, 10%, and compounded, and they bought it for pennies on the dollar. Now they want to get it returned at 100%. And they were backstopped by the European Central Bank using the same model as our Federal Reserve. Well, exactly how did trillions of dollars given to major corporations who caused the problem, how did that actually help the American public? It did not. It only helped those who made bad decisions and were rescued in whole. Those people who made good decisions were not helped at all. So look at Greece. They're willing to bankrupt the nation. They're willing to put the Greek citizens into receivership to take away all of their assets they hold in common, like their ports and their airports and their islands, and privatize them to inside members that will never be known. They will also take pensions that people worked hard their entire life and take over 50% of their money on their pensions, so people have to now literally fall into the poverty level. And then with no infrastructure, they can't clean their streets. They can't do any of the things that would keep Greece, as it once was, a very viable and beautiful and wonderful nation with a phenomenal people. Was it perfect? No, it wasn't. There was massive corruption within the wealthy who didn't pay any taxes or very rarely, and their defense, who bought two submarines worth billions of dollars that they never should have bought, and then had Wall Street's Goldman Sachs come in and loot them of hundreds of millions of dollars and hide how much in debt they really were. So they should have forgiven all the debt. And Greece, do the right thing. Get out of the European Union. You'll have more than enough people to trade with. You can start over and do it right this time. No more bloated bureaucracies, no more corruption, no more defense. You have nothing to defend yourself against. So why put billions of dollars in there? Put it into your schools, and helping the citizens of Greece who need it. I hope that England has taught a lesson to Irish people, citizens, French citizens, Italian citizens. And right now, the French and the Italians are over 240% debt to gross domestic product. They will never pay that off. They'll never get out. So they should look at restructuring their own society, going back to their own currency, and start over. That's all we have time for today. Thank you all for listening. I'll share more with you on Monday. Have a nice day, everyone.